From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Joni, a podcast series that tells the story of Joni Mitchell over the course of a year. My name is Andy, and I'll be your host throughout this audio journey. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I'd love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Joni. I'd also appreciate any positive reviews and feedback that you can leave. On this month's episode, we'll be taking a look at the experiences and struggles that would shape one of Joni Mitchell's most important albums. In late 1969, Joni Mitchell needed to get away. She was quickly becoming the queen of the hippie movement, and her relationship with Graham Nash was getting too serious too quickly. She packed lightly for her trip around the world, but made room for a new instrument she purchased at the Big Sur Music Festival a few months prior. And thus, the dulcimer entered the legend of Joni.
This was made for me by a girl named Joellen, who's this dynamite girl who lives in California, who makes these. And she carved all the sound holes. You can't really see them maybe, but they're so beautiful, little birds here. And that looks sort of like a bird with big cow eyes. There's a hawk on the end here. Here's another really new one that isn't quite finished, just for fun.
As mentioned last episode, Joni flew to Greece in hopes of being just another tourist. While many didn't recognize her famous smile, her gypsy clothing and flowing blonde hair stood out in the sophisticated streets of Athens. Over the course of her first few days, she kept being referred to by the locals as "Sheepy Sheepy Matala Matala." She eventually asked why she kept being called that, and they told her, "Go to Matala, in Crete. That's where your kind are." Joni would take a ferry to the Mediterranean getaway and would quickly find the hippie commune she'd been promised in Crete. There, she would find refuge in the oceanside man-made caverns. Within these catacombs, Joni would construct some of her greatest songs on her handy little dulcimer.
Anyway, here it is, the Appalachian dulcimer. And you can tune it any way you want to, just like any instrument, like the guitar or the piano. I'm going into a tuning now that I call Matala tuning, because I found it as well as the song I'm going to play in Matala, Crete.
During the day, Joni would venture into the small oceanside town of Matala and make friends with the locals. One of those new acquaintances would be a cook at the Delphi named Carrie Raddatz. The two would share a romance during her brief stay on the island. He would also inspire a Joni Mitchell classic.
The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave here, Carrie, but it's really not my home. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet. And I miss my clean white linen and my fancy French cologne. Oh, Carrie, get out your cane.
And
I'll put on some silk.
I'll put on some silk.
Oh, you're a mean old daddy. But
hi, I'm Carrie Raddatz. This is Matala. There was two tavernas, the Mermaid and the Delfini, where I work.
Come on down to the Mermaid Cafe, and I will buy you a bottle of wine.
So often we'd have Greek music, people throwing plates and glasses on the floor.
Oppa!
Let's have a round for these freaks and these soldiers, a round for these friends of mine. Let's have another round.
I resented her because a lot of my friends were turning into absolute fools and fawning all over Joni Mitchell. And so she was disturbing the tranquility of this little place.
Come on, Carrie, get out your cane.
Get out your cane.
Put on some
The first time I met her, she was seated at a table. I was serving people. And then she picked up all her trash from the table and came over to me. She cleaned up her table. And I just looked at it. You know, there are shards of broken glass and plates on the floor from last night. I just took it and threw it on the floor. Thank you.
You're a mean old daddy, but I like you. I like you. I like you.
She caught me in a weak moment, and then we became friends after that.
Maybe I'll go to Amsterdam, or maybe I'll go to Rome.
So she gave me a present of the song. It was on my birthday. This is my 24th birthday. It was a goodbye song.
But let's not talk about fare-thee-wells now. The night is a starry dawn.
There was a little bit of a sadness about that, but she was always leaving, and she'd change her mind, and we'd find something else to do or go traveling. Then over the years, of course, like all poetry, it tends to grow within you, and it tends to take on your own personal meanings and shadings and other memories that become associated with it.
I said, oh, you're a mean old daddy, but you're out of sight.
Here's a little personal tidbit for you listeners. My mom was such a big Joni Mitchell fan that she wanted to name me Carrie after the song. In fear of giving his youngest son a girl's name, my father stubbornly stood in opposition to it. I kind of wish he hadn't. As mentioned in the lyrics to Carrie, Joni missed her clean white linens and fancy French cologne, and while she enjoyed Winds of Africa and the Mermaid Cafe, she was already missing her home in Laurel Canyon, California. That yearning for home would result in another dulcimer classic, California. Once again, the crazy cook of Crete would make a brief appearance in the lyrics.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Oh, but California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset peak. California, I'm coming home. I met a redneck on a Grecian Isle who did the goat dance very well. He gave me back my smile, but he kept my camera in a cell. Oh, the rogue, the red, red rogue. He cooked good omelettes and stews, and I might have stayed on with him there, but my heart cried out for you. California, oh, California, coming home. Oh, make me feel good, rock and roll band. I'm your biggest fan. California, I'm coming home.
Before heading back to the Golden State, Joni would make brief stops in Spain, Italy, and the UK, where she met up with an up-and-coming songwriter. Joni had crossed paths with James Taylor several times during her final few months with Graham Nash, and she'd always found the lanky 21-year-old to be just her type, easygoing, aloof, and free-spirited. He was basically everything Nash wasn't. James was set to take the stage in London that night, and Joni would join him for several songs.
Thank you.
a song that James wrote, the lullaby. It's really beautiful.
Such a comfort to have you up here.
Yeah, I like having you up here too. Why don't we form a duo?
Go to New York City.
Go to New York City. Live in the Albert.
Live
struggle.
The Albert.
I'm a night owl, baby.
Throughout their performance, it's clear that Joni is charmed by Taylor, so it's no surprise that they would soon after begin dating, albeit long distance. After his tour, James would move to New Mexico to begin his acting debut in the film Two Lane Blacktop.
This man's dangerous, officer. He passed us on the right a couple of miles back. I swear he's going about 90. He must be on something.
Take it easy, man. You're going to kill us.
When Joni returned to the States, she would fly to the movie set to visit James, but his reception wasn't always the kindest. As she flew back to California, she wrote about the mix of emotions she felt about her young, troubled boyfriend.
You got the touch so gentle and sweet, but you got that look so critical. Now I can't talk to you, baby, I get so weak. Sometimes I think love is just musical. Up there's the heavens, down there's a town. Blackness everywhere and little light shine. Oh, darkness, blackness, dragging me down. Come on, light the candle in this poor heart of mine. Oh, star bright, you got the loving that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. I shouldn't have got on this flight tonight. Drinking sweet champagne, got the headphones up high. Can't numb you out, can't drum you out of my mind. They're playing
goodbye, baby, baby, goodbye. Ooh, love is blind. Ooh, love is blind.
Up go the flaps, down go the wheels. I hope you got your heat turned on, baby. I hope they finally fixed your automobile. Hope it's better when we meet again, baby. Star bright, you got the love that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. Shouldn't have gone on this flight tonight.
When filming completed, James would move into Joni's Laurel Canyon abode. The allure of California would be a bad mix for a young artist who was already struggling with substance abuse.
When people are young, they're blind in a way. They're very enthusiastic and they're very full of themselves, and they think that it's a sort of a narcissistic time, and you know, you're not worried about the rest of the world. You don't have kids, that's why, you know. So you don't have that connection. You're just into your own personal project. That's sort of what I think about that California time. People were there to have a good time, you know. And it was there were lots of drugs, psychedelics, marijuana, you know, cocaine eventually, plenty of alcohol, plenty of wine. You know, all of this was just part of the scene, and it was just people were there to have a good time. You know, the California scene. It was hugely creative, and it was a gas. It was a fucking ball.
Not only was Taylor enjoying the coastal drug culture, he was also interested in all the beautiful women that had moved to Hollywood in search of stardom. His wandering eye made the usually confident Joni a bit insecure. But at the end of the day, he was enjoying his time with the songstress, particularly in the bedroom, saying once in an interview, quote, "She's so sensual and free with her body, she's like a goddess of love."
We were living in Laurel Canyon at her house, and it was a wonderful time, you know. It was just great. We traveled a lot, you know. She sang beautifully on several songs of mine. I played on that album of hers. We had a great time. Oh, man, it was terrific. too good to last, I guess.
He would go on to write a song for her entitled You Can Close Your Eyes that captures the brief magic of their relationship.
Well, the sun is surely sinking down, but the moon is slowly rising. So this old world must still be spinning around, and I still love you. So close your eyes. You can close your eyes. It's all right. I don't know no love songs, and I can't sing the blues anymore, but I can sing this song, and you can sing this song when I'm gone.
Joni would also partake in some of Taylor's drug experimentations, one of them being acid. She recalls, quote, I took an overdose of acid. I only took one trip, and I took way too much. I had hallucinations at the beginning of the trip, but then after that, it was definitely mind-expanding. I saw cutting-edge physics, things that mystics have talked about, natives have talked about, the luminous fibers that connect everything. My social conduct was disrupted because I would weep at our society, and I'd weep at people. I could see right through them. And because everyone was becoming transparent, I felt I must be transparent, and I cried. In October, Joni would play the Isle of Wight Festival, an agonizing experience that would only heighten her feelings of phoniness and transparency. A crowd of 600,000 people had spent the past 4 days in the cramped quarters of the festival fences, and they were beginning to lash out at the performers. Joni was one of them.
I wanted to run off stage. That's, you know, you get your squirt of adrenaline, fight or flight. It seemed like appropriate time to flee, not to stand your ground. I sat there really wanting to run and but feeling that I couldn't.
I get my feelings off through my music. But listen, you got your life wrapped up in it, and it's very difficult to come out here and lay something down when people, it's like last Sunday I went to a Hopi ceremonial dance in the desert, and there were a lot of people there, and there were tourists, and there were tourists who were getting into it like Indians, and Indians who were getting into it like tourists. And I think that you're acting like tourists, man. Give us some respect.
I was trying desperately to find something to latch on to say. It became very emotional, very hurt, very, very mixed emotion, complex emotion, angry, you know, like ashamed of them in a certain way, indignant. After I said my little speech, the audience altered rapidly. And I had a revelation about audiences at that moment, that the first five rows, that it's a big dragon, it's a beast, and the first five rows are the eyes, and they telegraph all the way back to the tail, emotionally. The people in the front row, the ones that could see me and that I could see, immediately softened. They didn't They acted a bit like they had been reprimanded, but they warmed up. You know, I said, have some respect, and they did. I watched the rose back off, sit down, and they were quiet.
My old man, he's a singer in the park. He's a walker in the rain, oh, he's a dancer in the dark. We don't need no piece of paper from the city hall keeping us tied and true, my old man, keeping away my blues.
To this day, Joni refers to her sadness as the crying disease, although a psychiatrist would probably prescribe it as depression. Whatever the case, Joni soon after fell into a deep abyss of sadness and self-loathing. Her one-time run-in with acid would release strange dreams and bottled-up melancholy for the daughter she'd given up for adoption 5 years earlier. During a time when the young couple should have been celebrating their first Christmas together, Joni was at the piano, pouring out her soul in a song about the daughter she never knew.
It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees, they're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to fly.
The song would be a breakthrough for Joni, a realization that she could be honest about her sorrow and regrets and insecurities. Yes, she saw herself as transparent, but so wasn't everyone else she saw. She needed to speak for all of those feeling the emptiness she felt within.
He tried hard to help me, you know, he put me at ease, and he loved me so naughty, made me weak in the knees. Oh, I wish I had a river could skate away on. I'm so hard to handle, I'm selfish and I'm sad. Now I gone and lost the best baby that I ever had. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to fly. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby say goodbye.
Depression can be the sand that makes the pearl. Most of my best work came out of it.
It's coming on Christmas.
If you get rid of the demons or the disturbing things, if you get rid of them, then the angels fly off too. So there is a possibility in that mire of an epiphany.
Strangely, River has become a Christmas staple in recent years and has been covered by the likes of Barry Manilow, Sam Smith, Sarah McLachlan, and even James Taylor.
When I think of Joni writing the song, I think of her as being a Canadian, sort of stranded in L.A., trying to make Christmas work in Los Angeles. It's like a Los Angeles Christmas, you know, and she wishes she had a river she could skate away on. But I have to say, the song that I feel the most connection with is Joni's song, because she taught it to me herself. And I remember clearly her sitting at the piano and playing it when she was writing it. I think, you know, in years to come, it'll be a standard Christmas song. And I love it.
Unsurprisingly, Joni relishes the fact that she's written one of the few depressing Christmas songs.
We needed a sad Christmas song, didn't we? In the bah humbug of it all.
Yeah. So hard to handle.
As Joni struggled with her melancholy, James had his own demons, and they just so happened to coincide with his newfound fame. As his album Sweet Baby James flew up the charts to number 3, the 21-year-old was basking in excess.
It was in the late 60s, early 70s. It was a very exciting time and very unsettling. And the drummer from my band, The Flying Machine, was a heroin addict. And it was a matter of time before I got my first taste, and I was gone. As soon as I was introduced to opiates, I was gone.
Near the end of the year, the couple would play together at an anti-nuclear bomb testing concert in Amchica, Alaska, a show that would launch what we know today as Greenpeace. With the dueling anchors of Joni's depression and James' drug addiction, the show would be, in a way, the couple's swan song. They would break up soon after.
And if you hear laughing, spinning, skipping madly across the sun, it's not a dead end. Just sleeping on the run. And across the sky there are no fences facing. If you should hear big faces, the skipping feels a rhyme. To your tambourine in time, I wouldn't give them any mind. It's just the ragged down behind. It's the shadow that you're seeing.
Joni was devastated by the breakup. James had been there for her during her struggles, and she'd been there to support him in his many failed attempts to get clean. Now she was left to deal with her sadness alone, while also worrying what mistakes James might be making any given night. She would channel her desolation into her next album, Blue.
That if anybody looked at me, I'd burst into tears. I was so vulnerable and I felt so naked in my work.
Everybody's saying that hell's a hippest way to go. I don't think so, but I'm gonna take a look around at the blue. I love you. I love you.
individual psychological descent coincided, ironically, with my ascent into the public eye. They were putting me on a pedestal and I was wobbling.
Blue, here's a shell for you.
So, you know, I took it upon myself that since I was a public voice and was subject to this kind of weird worship, that they should know who they were worshiping.
There is a song from me.
I was demanding of myself a deeper and greater honesty, more and more revelation in my work, in order to give it back to the people where it goes into their lives and nourishes them and changes their direction and, you know, makes light bulbs go off in their head and makes them feel, and, you know, and it isn't vague. It strikes against the very nerves of their life. And in order to do that, you have to strike against the very nerves of your own.
During recording of the album in Studio C at A&M Records, Joni kept herself sequestered from everyone. She said of the sessions, quote, "People became transparent to me. People thought I had an evil eye. That's why we locked off the blues sessions. Nobody could come in. And if anybody did, I'd burst into tears." In an interview with Cameron Crowe, Joni said of Blue, quote, "By the time of my fourth album, I came to another turning point. That terrible opportunity that people are given in their lives. The day they discover to the tips of their toes that they're assholes. And you have to work from there." Blue really was a turning point in a lot of ways.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be? Oh, I hate you some, I hate you some, I love you some. Oh, I love you when I forget about me. I wanna be strong, I wanna live alone.
Joni may have been recording her album in hiding, but her songs were anything but guarded. Tracks like Little Green and River would hint toward the child she'd given up for adoption, while other tracks would intimately reveal the range of emotions she'd felt in her various relationships, and give more detail than any tabloid could have scrounged up. The track list plays like a boyfriend hit list. All I Want and This Flight Tonight capture the giddiness of a new relationship with James Taylor. My Old Man would discuss the give and pull of her serious relationship with Graham Nash. Carrie, of course, was about the carefree love of her summer fling with Carrie Raddatz. A Case of You would be a fond remembrance of her time with Leonard Cohen. And album closer, The Last Time I Saw Richard, was a bleak rumination on her marriage with Chuck Mitchell and the demise of youthful optimism.
The last time I saw Richard was Detroit in 68, and he told me all romantics meet the same fate someday. Cynical and drunk and boring someone in some dark cafe. "You laugh," he said, "you think you're immune. Go look at your eyes, they're full of moon. You like roses and kisses and pretty men to tell you all those pretty lies, pretty lies. When you're gonna realize they're only pretty lies, only pretty lies."
For the first time, Joni would use a photograph as cover art rather than her traditional use of one of her paintings. For an album of blunt realism, the image matched the album's tenor. She would bring in friend Gary Burden to create the iconic Indigo photograph.
When it came time to do Blue, she wanted to try something different, and she asked me to do her cover for her. I'm very proud of that album cover. I think it's one of the best album covers I've made, and I think it's the only Joni Mitchell album that's not her artwork. What I tried to do was to make something that it was really simple and classic and classy. Rather than just use a black and white photo on an album that was called Blue, I knew that there was such a thing as called ferrocyanotypes, and so I took a black and white photo and turned it into a ferrocyanotype looking blue package. I love Joni Mitchell's music. I'm a huge fan of her poetry and music. But for me, that's the best one. And how cool that I got to do it.
When Blue was released in June of 1971, the first response from fans and the music community was shock. Was a songwriter supposed to reveal this much about themselves?
I remember playing it for Kris Kristofferson, and he was kind of shocked by it, said, "Oh, Joni, you know, save something of yourself." I think he felt that I had gone to reveal too much or something. I'd laid myself too vulnerable.
Once the initial alarm of Joni's brutal honesty soaked in, adoration for the album was undeniable. Peter Riley of the Stereo Review called it near perfection. But the finest thing about Blue is its message of survival. Tom Pretty of the Greenville News wrote, "Joni is unabashedly feminine and unafraid to write highly autobiographical songs. Blue is a collection of songs of love, love of a man, love of a home, love of music." Here's critics Stephen Holden and Bill Flanagan discussing the album and its legacy.
It was naked, pulsating, great poetry. Blue just went to a level of psychic pain and honesty that no one else had ever written before, and no one else has written since.
Blue turned forever on its head the notion of what a songwriter was expected to be. Joni became enormously popular through that, and people didn't just love her the way that people love the Rolling Stones or Motown. They really felt, this woman, by the light of this record player, is looking into my soul. You know, a very confusing place for the artist to find herself, too.
At the time of release, Rolling Stone's Don Heckman loved the album but feared fans wouldn't get it, saying, quote, "Despite the fact that it attempts more and makes greater demands of her talents than any of the other albums, I suspect it'll be her most disliked." Boy, was he wrong. Today, Blue is widely considered one of the greatest albums of all time. In 2003, it ranked number 30 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time, and it would make a similar list compiled by Time magazine in 2006. She was the highest-ranked female in both cases. In 2017, NPR would rank it number 1 in their list of the top 150 greatest albums made by women. It would receive multiple awards over the span of the last 40 years, including a Grammy Hall of Fame Award in 1999, given to albums that had, quote, qualitative or historical significance. The album would peak at number 15 on the charts, but today, it stands as Joni's highest-selling album of all time. Exposing her depression and relationship struggles to a massive audience helped garner attention, but it also opened up her private life for the world to see.
The club thing was very informal and kind of fun. Whereas the big stage, I hated from the moment that I went up there. I didn't like that lofty adoration. It seemed diluted. The idea of people at my knees was just horrifying to me. Fame made me really nervous and uncomfortable.
You know, maybe I'm kind of weird, but you know, when I'm sitting up here and playing and I hear all those people growling out there and people saying, "Joni, smile for Amsterdam" and stuff, it really puts me uptight and I forget the words and then I get nervous and it's really a drag.
I began to dislike more and more being a public person.
Give me a little help, will you, so that I can...
So I isolated myself and I made my attempt to get back to the garden.
Joni runs away to the Canadian wilderness on the next Year of the Joni.
Heard it in the wind last night, sounded like applause. Chilly now, end of summer, no more shiny hot nights. It was just the arbutus rustling and the bumping of the logs, and the moon swept down black water like an empty spotlight.
We'll be right back. If you enjoyed today's episode and don't want to wait another month for the next installment, go check out the other two seasons of the Year of the Podcast series. For the David Bowie story, search Year of the Bowie, and the Neil Young story is Year of the Neil. Both podcasts are available on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also check out my monthly podcast entitled BDWPS Podcast, where I play some of my favorite new music coming from the underground. If you are interested in exploring any of the interviews or songs played on this month's episode, a works cited list can be found on bdwps.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a month.